The larger goal along the way is more to use 1 Samuel as our practice in learning how to become better readers of Old Testament narrative. So that 1 Samuel is kind of the text where we develop the skills that we're talking about so that we could then take them to go and read Judges or read Kings or read the Gospels even. And so I want not just to be talking about 1 Samuel as we go and getting into the text, but also reflecting more explicitly on how to read well. And not just modeling that or bringing the fruit of that, but hopefully helping us as a group kind of develop that, hone and sharpen our skills in that regard. So this handout that I've passed out, and I think we'll make sure it's already on sermon audio from earlier, but we'll see if we can put it on this week as well. And I do have several copies printed. These are questions that are drawn from a textbook I used called Reading the Historical Books, A Student's Guide to Engaging the Biblical Text. It's a really helpful book. It obviously covers more than Samuel, although it certainly includes Samuel. And as Patricia Dutcher-Walls is the author there, and as she goes through the chapters, at the end of each chapter, if I recall, she has gathered together some key questions to ask as you're reading to kind of help you catch on or attune to things that the narrator is doing. And so these questions are gathered from that. So I'd love to get to 1 Samuel 5 this morning, but first I'd like to walk through these questions and maybe think about how the questions might be helpful or think about things these questions bring to mind about passages we've already read or other things we notice, and just kind of pause in the text of 1 Samuel for a little bit and reflect more directly on how we read. So the question she begins with, right? One of the first things we think about when, or usually don't think about, but do automatically when we're reading a text is the boundaries. Where's the beginning and end of the text? If the text is broken down into smaller units, how do we identify those units? And that's usually something we do automatically. But what are the things that feed into that? She gives us some specific questions in that. You know, where are the beginning and end of the narrative? How are these marked? And is the narrative part of a larger story or ongoing storyline? How do you think we would answer questions like that? I mean, if we've got the beginning of a book, right, like with 1 Samuel chapter 1, that probably marks the beginning of that narrative. But let's step away from Old Testament narrative for a bit. Think about a show that you're watching, right? And usually in a 40-minute episode, there are lots of things going on. We kind of know where the beginning and end of the episode are because of the time on the clock when it starts, right? The commercial break is over and here it starts. Or more and more because we hit play on Netflix, right? But how do we know, if you think about that story or that episode as being divided into smaller bits, how do we know where those bits begin and end? Yeah, so usually if we think about something like a television episode, and narrative episodes are not as far removed from this as it feels like they are, usually an episode is divided into scenes. And within a scene, we might have several shots, which we think about like as changes in camera angle and focus, things like that. We have analogous things in narrative as we read. And so you mentioned transitions. What would be examples of some transitions that would help us recognize boundaries between scenes, for instance? Okay, so if we're watching a show, if it all goes to black, and then what's usually different about before it goes to black and when it comes back from going to black? There's a location change. So fade to black, or change in the intensity of the music, or beginning of a new part of the soundtrack. But along with that, a change in location. Not always a change in location. What else can sometimes happen? Either together with or instead of a change in location. Change of speaker. Yeah, or a character change more broadly, right? I think of Shakespeare plays, like A Midsummer Night's Dream, right? Where we're in the same place in the forest, but different people are on the stage now. What else can happen that we can recognize as a scene change? Change in location, character change, time change. Time changes that are noted, day to night, different time of day. And there are very in-your-face ways of noting these changes, and there are also sometimes much more subtle ways of noting those changes. Okay, so this helps us break an episode down into scenes, and then those scenes usually contribute something in particular to the plot. A new scene will usually signal some kind of new plot development, a new problem will be introduced, or someone who will later be a key to resolving things comes in the second or third scene, usually not the first. Or maybe they're introduced in the first, but it seems completely irrelevant until we're much further down. We saw this in 1 Samuel, right? In the first chapter, there's this very fleeting mention of the two sons of Eli. Right? And they don't seem to have any relevance at all to what's going on in chapter 1. But it becomes the focus as we see the rise of Samuel and the demise of Eli, this contrast between Hannah's son and Eli's sons. Right? So these two who are introduced seemingly gratuitously and irrelevantly in chapter 1 take on particular importance over the next few chapters. Okay. What about an episode as being a part of a larger story? Think back to TV shows again, right? Some TV shows, every episode's the same. Like there's a formula, and there's really no character development from one episode to another. Sometimes we don't even have the same main characters. But sometimes the main characters just never change. But usually, and I would submit in the shows that we tend to enjoy more, although each episode has its own narrative arc, there's a much longer development over the course of seasons. So that if you have a friend who's really excited about this particular show, and you jump in with them in the middle of season 3, there are private jokes between the characters, and there are things that your friend laughs at, and you have no idea what's going on, right? Because you've missed 2.5 seasons of that character development. It sounds like we've experienced some of this with each other, yeah, right? There are things that don't make sense without the backstory that comes as a part of this larger development. And that it actually becomes a key element of how to read Old Testament narrative well. Is stopping to think about not just where are we in this scene and what's going on and who's here and where are we in sort of the episode in history, but also what's going on in the larger story. Where are we in the history of redemption? Where are we in the kind of the unfolding of the narrative of the history of the people of God? And alongside that, I don't know if her questions will bring this up much. But another relevant question about that is to think about the implied readers. If we think about a first audience for the text, who were they? who does it seem to have been written to in the first instance? And so how would they have understood the relevance of what's going on? Right. So there are our first three questions that help us with those, some of those things, right? Where are the beginning and the end of the narrative? How are these marked? We've talked about some ways those might be marked. And is the narrative part of a larger story or ongoing storyline? And the answer to that is almost always yes. Even when it seems like the answer is no. The answer is almost always yes. Right? We think about that with the Joseph narrative. Right? Joseph is sold into Egypt by his brothers. And he gets down there and things are awful. And then we just kind of pause Joseph's story to hear about something that takes place in Judah, in his family, probably over a period of a decade, decade and a half, if not longer. Like, why is this relevant at all to what happens to Joseph? And then we find out late in the story of Joseph that Judah is suddenly in this place where his character has been transformed and he's willing to put his life in the place of his brother. And it turns out that this chapter that's inserted early on that seems like it's completely irrelevant to what's going on explains this transformation in Judah, explains why he, as not being the firstborn, is the one who is able to take the position of leadership that you would expect the firstborn to take. So that one, especially when the answer seems like no, it's usually worth pushing to think through why is this here? Why is this here? It's not an accident. It's not gratuitous. One thing I think you probably know or experience from reading is Old Testament narrators are not Charles Dickens. They're not even Hemingway, although they're closer to Hemingway, right? They're very, very sparse on detail. You don't get, you know, as Hannah enters, she goes to worship and prays, you don't get lengthy descriptions of the smell of the incense as she's standing there. You don't get a developed picture over two pages of the inner workings of Eli's thoughts as he's assessing the situation and thinking about who she is. It's very short on detail. Which means the detail's always there for a reason. And even details that feel like they're just there for the sake of filling out the picture are usually also telling us something.
So a situation that they sense. You know,
yes.
As well as Mike addresses that a lot of times in the sermons. And Chad did the other night, about 7 years. You know, he put me, he applied what really went on.
There's so much assumed knowledge on the part of the narrator, much of which we can fill in by just continuing to read the Bible with attention. I love the idea of reading through the Bible every year, but I also love the idea of reading it in big chunks. Most of those reading plans have you read like a couple chapters of Old Testament and one of the Psalms and a chapter of the New Testament. And the Old Testament, they often go in sequence in the books, but the New Testament, they don't want to give you four Gospels in a row. And so they'll give you like a Gospel and then you finish that and you'll do an Epistle and then you'll come back and read another Gospel. And that can turn out to be really helpful, especially if you get behind Not that that ever happens, right? You end up reading two passages that turn out to be related to each other at the same time across testaments. But it's also really helpful to read big chunks at a time. I remember being deeply impressed by Nathan Saint's biography. Nate Saint was one of the five missionaries who was killed in Ecuador in the 1950s. And his mother had the consistent habit of every Sunday afternoon, she would sit down and read one of the four Gospels in its entirety. And she did that every week. I don't have that habit. I'd love to have a habit like that. I would know the Gospels so much better, but it would also then give me a sensitivity to times elsewhere in Scripture where something echoes the Gospels or is echoed in the Gospels, or a passing reference in Paul to something in the life of Jesus. I'd be so much more attuned to being able to pick that up. So, and that's one thing that I've found in 1 Kings, for instance. If you know well the law of the king as it's given in the second half of Deuteronomy 17, right? The Lord anticipates that the people of Israel will want a king. He knows that. He's not against that, but he gives in great detail what that king should look like. This is what their character should be. This is what their habits should be. These are the things they should do and the things that they should not do. If you read the first 11 chapters of 1 Kings without that background, you know by chapter 11 that this is not going well, right? Solomon, who started with this great wisdom, something's gone awry. It's probably his wife's fault, right? And everything is awful. But if you have that background of Deuteronomy 17, if you've internalized that description of what to expect in a godly king, things are going wrong in chapter 3 and chapter 4. As soon as Solomon's on his own, he starts making horrible decisions. He amasses vast amounts of horses for himself. And he goes back to Egypt to get them. Right? And these things are kind of stated without comment by the narrator because he's assuming that knowledge. He doesn't have to tell you early on, hey, Solomon's wearing a black hat. Because for him and for his readers, they have this background knowledge where they can be like, ooh, that's not good. Right. When you watch the movies, right? Even more recent movies, if you have a character who wears black and they smoke cigarettes, they're probably the villain in this story. Now, sometimes a producer will play with your expectations and turn them on their head. They'll use that to kind of lead you to expect this, and then, oh, actually. But usually those things are signals that this is the bad guy, right? The one who comes into town and doesn't know anybody, and he's wearing a black hat, and he's kind of grumpy, he's usually the bad guy. And the one who rides in on a white horse and is wearing a white hat is usually the good guy. And Old Testament narrative has these kinds of clues that it lays before us also. But it's very rare, which is why it's so interesting in these early chapters of 1 Samuel, because he does at various points. It's usually very rare for the narrator to actually kind of step out from behind the story and say, and he was a bad man. So, as part of working out where those boundaries are and where do we note the transitions, the next three questions she offers are: what events and scenes take place? Who is in each scene? And we've already asked in a general way, what are the transitions between scenes? And one of the ways we recognize those are, you know, in watching a show, fade to black, but is there a change in location? Is there a character change? Is there a time change? We could also say, is there a change in the pace? Do we move from describing something that happens over the course of an hour to describing something that happens over the course of a couple of years? Right? When we think about that transition from the conversation between Hannah and Eli to kind of giving a summary over a couple of paragraphs of the next couple of years of Hannah's life and giving birth to a son. Other key questions to ask. What is the problem or conflict driving the plot? And if we think about scenes, episodes, larger narratives, larger structures, sometimes, right, there will be plots within an episode. We talked about this a little bit. Those are terrible plot lines. But alongside and over that, there's a larger plot that's part of the overall structure. Right? And the example we used for that are TV episodes and then, you know, the plot line of seasons and that character development. What complications are introduced as the plot is worked out? Where is the crisis or turning point? Sometimes there's more than one. So are there multiple turning points, or some have described an area of turbulence where things get really weird? Sometimes you can see it even in the structure of the language. The sentences kind of go crazy where that turning point happens. What happens in the resolution phase? Because that turning point isn't the end, right? There's just what we might call falling action, or as that resolution kind of works itself out. And are there expectations that are set up by the story? Are those expectations fulfilled or broken or changed? Right? And those are important places to look for. Does it move in a different direction? Does something unexpected happen? Right? Even in 1 Samuel, right? Eli's demise has been announced. It happens over time, but his sons and he himself die in the same day. And so now we have the faithful priest, right? That's what's supposed to happen. That's what we've been told to expect. God will raise up a faithful priest. We're going to pause that, right? And we're going to follow the arc for a couple of chapters before we circle back to Samuel, who may or may not be the faithful priest that we've been told to look for. So pay attention to that, right? As we keep going. Do these seem helpful? These may remind you of a high school literature course or a college literature course. There are a lot of ways that the skills that we have and that we develop as just good readers of literature in general, and that sounds like it's, you know, in the ivory tower with these great books. It's also what makes us good watchers of TV shows, right? We apply those skills in those settings also. So don't sell yourself short on that. We just don't often stop and think about those things, right? Usually watching a TV show, we can figure out that this happened earlier. And sometimes they'll say, you know, they'll suddenly switch and go 48 hours earlier, right? And they'll back up. But sometimes they don't. And there are things that happen that we're able to pick up on that clue us in that, oh, that actually what we just saw is something that happened later. And now we've backed up and we're watching what happened before. Well, it happens in things we read, too. What I've often found, though, is those skills that we've developed as readers and listeners and watchers, we kind of leave at the door when we come in and sit down and read the Bible together. I'm not really sure why that is. And it doesn't always happen, but it's a curious phenomenon that when we're watching a show or we're reading a book, we immediately recognize that these things are given to us out of sequence. But when we sit down and read the Bible, we automatically assume, and in fact we're really reticent to, really, really resistant to the idea that it could be otherwise, that this is in chapter 15, so it must be that it happened after what's in chapter 14. Even when there are clues that really push us in the other direction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It gets really interesting as we get later in Samuel. We start to get this picture of Saul just kind of unraveling. Is completely unraveling. And it gets really confusing around where David kills Goliath. Because before David kills Goliath, in the chapter before, David is brought into Saul's service. Right? Playing the harp for him to calm his troubled mind. But in the next chapter, when he comes to bring things to his brothers on the battlefield, he doesn't appear to have been in Saul's service. Saul doesn't seem to know who he is or where he's from. And that's left unresolved for us. There are these tensions that are evident in the text, and a lot of people have spent a lot of ink arguing that this is an example of the Bible contradicting itself, and I don't think it's that at all. I think it's a very skillful narrator who's left ambiguous for us whether these things are out of order or whether this is in fact the sequence in which things happen. But by leaving it there and leaving it with that tension, it highlights the way Saul is coming apart. He's coming apart mentally, he's coming apart emotionally, and it really throws the light on his inadequacy and unfitness to be a leader. He can't lead men in general. He can't lead a nation. He can't master himself. And he certainly can't lead an army. The one who stands head and shoulders above all of his fellow Israelites, such that he can't hide when they're looking for him, is cowering in his tent when ruddy, cute little boy David, right, says, "I'll fight him." Right? This unknown, you know, kid from Hicktown with a basket full of cheese. Right? So, anyway, let's look at other questions. So, does repetition occur at any level within the story? Words, phrases, events, scenes. I really, really don't like the New American Standard as a translation. I feel like it's terrible English. It's really, really terrible English. But one of the reasons it's terrible English is because it tries to very consistently always translate a Greek word or a Hebrew word the same way every time in English. That's horrible for communicating faithfully in English what Greek or Hebrew are communicating. And it creates really awkward sentences. But it's supremely useful when you're trying to track keywords in a text, right? Most of us have not had the opportunity to study Greek or Hebrew. Some of us who have an awful lot of dust to kind of blow off our language skills, even when we do. And so an English translation that at the expense of the English will do something like that for us can be really useful for helping us track. Where are these keywords? Where are these puns? Where do these things keep being used in a way that we wouldn't translate it that way normally in English, because it would obscure the meaning. But it does help us track those word plays and those repetitions and some of those key words. So most of us, I think, have a favorite translation, probably even a faithful Bible, and usually we read from that. But there's an argument for reading a variety of translations, right? Because they usually have different wheelhouses, right? And the New American Standard, as much as I loathe what it does to the English language, is really useful in that sense for tracking those keywords and those repetitions. Really wary now of that being on a recording, that I don't like the New American Standard, but I'd be happy to say it. Honestly, before I learned the languages, I had very, very strong opinions about English translations. And after learning the languages, I have equally strong but almost polar opposite very strong opinions about English translations. So that's been an interesting journey. So does repetition occur at any level within the story? Words, phrases, events, scenes. So at the word level, right, one thing that we keep seeing over the course of these early chapters are comments about Eli's sight, his blindness. Even in the description of the word of the Lord as it comes to Samuel, it plays on the idea of vision and sight and what he can see, or a seer, right? And that's deliberate, and it causes us to see Eli in a particular light. So that would be an example of a repetition of words or phrases, even across chapters. What about events? Right? A repetition of events. So if you think about Genesis, right? Three times with two different people, we have a patriarch try to pass off his wife as his sister. Why is that? Is it because there's this one original folktale that existed in the oral tradition passed down in Israel, and they got really confused about actually who did it, when, and where, and so we end up with three different versions, and they get worked into the text as we have it, and everybody knows that that's actually not really true, it's made up, and or is it something that highlights the weakness of the patriarchs, a struggle they have in trusting the Lord? Does it highlight for us a way in which father is like son? Right? And those struggles and that weakness, and the same kind of human attempts to manage what God has already promised he will take care of, pass from one generation to the next. They help us see those characters in similar light. And human behavior is pretty predictable. We have a set way of going about things and trying to make things right. Think about what happens when you see that police car in your rearview mirror. It doesn't matter what speed you're going. You will hit the brakes. Every one of you. It's really funny to watch, actually, if you're not in the car. Maybe you're sitting and eating a sandwich at McDonald's and there's a speed trap across the street, or just a police officer sitting there trying to finish his breakfast, right? And you can watch these cars, and some of them are going too fast, but even the ones that are going a little slow, there's a whoop as the hood goes down as they hit their brakes as soon as they see that police car, right? And that plays out in other ways in human behavior. But when the narrator highlights that, they're drawing our attention to something, right? The behavior of this character should remind you of their father or the one that this is like. There are also repetition of whole scenes. And that plays out in two ways, right? One is this is really, really, really important, and so we're going to go back through all of it again. We get that with Isaac finding a wife, right? The servant comes, he meets the wife at the well, and the narrator describes everything that's happened. And we've gotten all of this information, but then he comes and sits down with her family, and then he repeats everything that's just happened. So we get two chapters that it's almost the same thing, but in this chapter it's the narrator telling it, and in this chapter it's Abraham's servant telling it. And that's because this is such a key and important event in the history of the people of God. Right? We get that in a slightly, and I'll come back to that in a moment, but we get that in a slightly different way in the second half of Exodus. Right? It seems so repetitive. We get chapter upon chapter upon chapter of the instructions for building the tabernacle. Right? And then something happens. But then we get chapter upon chapter upon chapter of them carrying out those instructions for the tabernacle. Right? A bell, a pomegranate, a bell, a pomegranate, right? All these twisted linen and the yarn and the posts and the gold-plated tables. But if you think about what else is going on, right? What happens in between there? in between the giving of those instructions and the carrying out of those instructions, we have the golden calf. And we have the Lord telling Moses, essentially, right, stand back, I'm going to zap them and I'm going to start over with you. And Moses puts himself, as it were, in between the Lord and his people to intercede for them and plead that it not be so. Pleads the covenant on behalf of God's people with the Lord. So the carrying out of those instructions every step along the way is a reminder that God is still with his people, that he will still get them to the land. Right? The length of the description, the detail of the description, I like to think of as Christmas dinner at your grandmother's house. You remember the color of the tablecloth. You remember the smell of things cooking in the oven. You remember the sound of the knock of different family members as they arrive. You remember the ornaments on the tree and where they were and what year that was given, right? So it's a celebration of all of that meaningful detail in the midst of also a celebration that the episode with the golden calf did not result in us being wiped out. But God showed mercy on us. But we also have repetition of scenes on a different level. If we go back to Isaac, and I think I've talked about this in a CE class before, so this may sound familiar, but we also have what's called a type scene. And there are lots of different kinds of type scenes. But one we see, the first instance we see, is with Abraham's servant going to find a wife for Isaac. And where does he find her? He finds her at a well. So a man who's looking for a wife for himself or someone else finds an eligible young woman at a well, and then a couple chapters later, we have a wedding, right? Well, where do we see that again? Where does Jacob find his wife? Right? Jacob travels back to the same place, probably the same well, and meets an eligible young woman, and we have a wedding. Or two. Yeah. Yeah, we get variation in the midst of the repetition. With Moses, it's passed over very quickly, over the course of about five verses instead of a whole chapter. But with Moses, at the end of chapter 2, right, as he's fleeing Egypt, he ends up in a place where there's a well, and there are all these young, right, I think seven daughters come, and he makes it possible for them to draw water and then follows them back to their father's household, and then he gives one of his daughters to him. A young man, some young women, a well, a wedding. Right? Where do we see that again? We see that with Jesus in John 4. Jesus comes and sits at a well. There's a woman there. But here we have the variation in the repetition, right? Is this an eligible young woman? She's had five husbands. And the one she's with now is not her husband, right? Jesus puts his finger on that. But do we have a wedding? Of sorts, right? Not only this woman, but her entire village come to know Jesus and become a part of the bride of Christ through that encounter with this young man at a well. And then we'll talk about it in more detail a little bit later, but we combining that question of repetition with expectations the story builds that are then frustrated. We'll see that Saul meets some young women at a well. And I'll just leave it there. I'll just leave it there. If that doesn't bring to mind something, then we'll just let it. We'll see if you notice it when we get there. It's very, very interesting. So does repetition occur at any level within the story? Are there command, enact, report sequences in the narrative? Right? A place in the narrative where God tells someone to do something, the narrator describes them doing it, and then someone talks about it happening. And along that line, she may bring this up in other questions, but it's very important to pay attention to what the narrator says happens and what a character says happens. Sometimes there's almost a one-to-one correspondence. Sometimes there's something the narrator thinks is important that a character doesn't. Sometimes there's a significant disconnect between what the narrator says happens and what a character says. And that is one of the ways, that's one of the tools the narrator employs to tell you this is not a trustworthy person. This is not a godly man. So pay attention to those kinds of details. More on the repetition. Does the repeated element confirm, change, contradict, or comment on the previous speech or event or element? Right? The repetition is never gratuitous. It's not there for the sake of ornamentation. So what is the repetition highlighting when it's used? What direct description of characters is given by the narrator? Again, this is very rare. It's very sparse. So when direct description is given, it's very important. Where someone is from is important. Who their father is. And that's usually a significant part of how someone is introduced. What region are they from? What family do they belong to? If they have a particular position or office, that's usually mentioned. So those details are important, but especially anything extra is very, very important. How do actions by characters aid in their characterization? The narrator will again, usually not tell you what to think about a character, but will show you how they behave. Right? And do the actions give a depiction of the type of person? We see that with Eli. Right? What are we left thinking of Eli? Looking at how he interacts with Hannah pastorally. And what we see of the way he parents his sons and admonishes them. How does dialogue add to the characterization of the main characters? Who speaks in the story and who does not speak? It's so interesting that Hannah speaks so much and Elkanah so little in those chapters, those first couple of chapters. Are a character's words reliable, confirmed by others or by the narrator or by things that happen? Through whose eyes are we seeing each scene? I have a typo here. Within an all-knowing narrator's viewpoint, do we see any other points of view? So the narrator in Scripture is omniscient. They know all the details and they will tell us some of them. But in doing so, do we get a glimpse of the points of view of the characters in the story, for instance? Do we hear the inner thoughts of any character? It was a very interesting observation that someone had to point out to me that I had never thought about. There's only one place in the entire David story where we get a glimpse of the inner David. Every other time he speaks, it's in front of other people. So watch for that as we read. What to make of that, we'll see. We'll see. But it's a very interesting thing to note. Is the point of view of any character consistently denied to the reader? How are events related in the sequencing of the story? Are there indications of simultaneous events, use of the past, or indications of the future? Right? Again, we recognize those things when we're reading a story. We recognize those things when we're watching a show, watch for those things as we read Scripture, right? Is this, you know, is chapter 3 something that happens in a different location at the same time as the events in chapter 2, right? Is chapter 15 something that actually happened before chapter 14, but it's placed here for some other reason, right? Pay attention. That those are all of the tools that are at the disposal of a good narrator or a storyteller are used in Scripture. Narrating things out of order, highlighting certain things, using repetition to make you think of characters in certain ways, right? Those are all used by the biblical writers, so watch for them. Where does time move slowly or quickly in the story, right? It moves so slowly in that encounter between Hannah and Eli. And it moves so quickly from there to the time that Samuel is brought and lent to the Lord at the sanctuary. Does time jump in transitions between scenes? What words, phrases, and ideas are brought forward by the ways the text makes them present to the reader? We have more copies of this. I'm sorry, they're on the copier. But this is the handout that we've used. Yes, yes. I'm so sorry. What words, phrases, ideas are brought forward by the ways the text makes them present to the reader? Again, think of those, all the different words that describe eyesight or vision or blindness or dimness. As we saw Eli and as we see Samuel coming to be known as a prophet. What is emphasized by the text or across texts, again, particularly by that repetition of words, phrases, and ideas? What characters have authority in the story? Or in what ways are certain figures made the focus of authority arguments so that they function with influence in subsequent chapters? How do characters then use their authority to affect or shape the actions and ideas of others? How is repetition used to craft a persuasive argument or make a point or idea more evident and forceful in the text? Think about the multiple times David has an opportunity to lay a hand on Saul, but refuses to stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed, even though he is also the Lord's anointed. Where do you see repetition working across adjacent texts? And where does it work across lengthy spans of chapters? What analogies are created between accounts in which two figures or events are shaped so that they resonate with each other and thus inform the reader about the characteristics of both ends of the analogy? Think about the end of Judges and the way Gibeah is described to bring to mind Sodom. Right. How this Israelite town is portrayed in a way that deliberately reminds you of a town that the Lord destroyed by fire and brimstone. What direct evaluation is included in the text, right? This is the rare explicit comment of the narrator. Right? How is it expressed, and what values, judgments, and ideals does it convey? What patterns are set up in the text, and in particular across texts? And what are the elements of the pattern in each case? You can track across Scripture this pattern of seeing something, noticing something with your eyes, discerning that it's desirable, and then reaching out and taking it. That's never a good thing. Where do we first see it? We see it in Genesis 3. We see it with Eve, with her inner process for why should she believe the serpent and take this fruit. But we see it all over Scripture. We see it with Samson. He sees the Canaanite woman, that she is right in his eyes. And so he sends his parents to go get her for him. Right? We see it in so many other places, right? That's one of those patterns that's set up across texts. So how do direct evaluation and pattern setting work together to convey judgments across stories? And what does the omission of an established pattern communicate about a figure, event, or idea? We'll come back to that in particular when we see Saul meeting young women at a well and what comes of it. What figures are set up as models for other characters in the historical books? Think of Moses in particular. Right? What values and ideas does the model express? And David, as we get later in the books, right? The later kings are evaluated in terms of, over against David. So, what values and ideas does the model express? And how do those values and ideas transfer to the other figures who follow the model? How does the story create dramatic impact through strong words, dramatic language, vivid scenes, and powerful characters? What does the dramatic impact tell you about where the story focuses its interests? And we'll often find that we have certain questions when we read a text. And what the narrator wants us to get from the story has often not a lot to do with the questions we have about the text. Their focus is somewhere else. So, what details are included in the text? Where does the flow of the story in the text slow down to include extra attention to particulars, including formats like lists and extended descriptions? So these are some examples of really useful questions to kind of have in your toolbox as you read narrative. Again, these are drawn from a particular book that's mentioned at the top of the front page, Reading the Historical Books by Patricia Dutcher Walls. But I would encourage you, you don't want to sit down and read through this entire list every time you read a chapter. But maybe using this as the bookmark for 1 Samuel as we continue through the text and looking over it every once in a while as you read, and maybe even letting it trigger things that you realize you noticed in a previous chapter and going back and rereading that section and attending to those details. So thanks for letting us take a moment to kind of pause 1 Samuel and reflect a little more explicitly about how we read and how we can read better. And let's use this and other observations like that as we continue. So we'll pick up next week and probably talk about 5 and 6 together in a little more detail. But read it with these questions in mind, if you would.